Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, everybody. Not live from New York this week. I'm live from Auburn, California. I'm sitting outside of Starbucks where I've got a nice Wi-Fi signal. And it's very different from the Starbucks in the West Village, I've noticed. no piercings. And people seem like they're, you know, off of Ozzy and Harriet or some truck driver movie or whatever.
Mm. Well, hey, hi, Dave. I'm sitting here in the studios in NYU, and we're very glad to have made contact with you while you're on the road, and we're proving the magic of mobile communications, aren't we?
Something like that.
Yeah.
This actually works.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're very optimistic about that. How is New York, by the way?
Beautiful.
It's got a heat wave.
Yeah, but it's normal spring weather now, and the trees blossomed, and now they have their thick green leaves, and things are looking up in New York.
That's great. I look forward to getting back. And when I get back, I will no longer be a bi-coastal person. I will simply be an east coastal person.
Yeah, that's a big move.
Yeah. Well, I decided I couldn't handle the, you know, I'm not one of these people that can live in two places at once. And my brain sort of needs to say, okay, this is home.
Mm-hmm.
Every place else is not home, right? And I don't know how people manage having, you know whatever. I can't even do two. And so I spent this last week in California sorting through a whole life, basically. I've moved, oh, God knows how many times in my life, and I have all the, you know, possessions to prove it. And but this was a very careful sort of sorting through everything, and I now feel much better in touch with my past self and ready to feed the future.
Well, that's great.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah.
It is. Feels pretty good.
Kind of.
And I have a drive. I'm driving all the way across the United States. I'm just beginning that trip right now, and that's always, for me, been a rite of passage. I've done this many times before.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish I could do that. I haven't done that in a long time.
We'll fly out. I'll meet you in Salt Lake City. The rest of the trip was
we have a lot of rebooting the news business to get to here, Dave. So,
Tell me about it. Let's go.
And okay, our listeners are eager to hear from us because we missed a show last week due to moving.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
No, it's no problem. We have to work around
our lives.
Why don't
we just mention briefly that you and I are both going to be at a conference next week, I think it is, a week from tomorrow. And your topic, I saw you came up with a topic for your speech.
Right.
What is that? If you don't mind me asking.
The topic is the self-informing public. And
there you go.
I'm going to try and take the discussion about news and journalism and Twitter back many centuries and bring it forward. And the starting insight will be that news is much, much older than journalism.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, makes sense. Yeah. Journalism's a relatively new thing, right? I
mean, it is. It is. And professional journalism is less than 100 years old. So, so I want to disentangle those two things and then bring them forward and then show what Twitter is changing about the equation. Anyway, that's my idea. I have 10 minutes, and I think it'll be perfect for a 10-minute talk. And what are you going to do?
I think 10 minutes, I think it's a very sort of revolutionary idea to sort of cram an idea into 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I came up with the topic of my talk,
which
although
is?
It's subject to change. And it's my topic is Hello, New York.
Hello, New York. Oh, I like that.
Hello, New York. In other words, here I am,
right,
and this is what I think, you know. And to me, New York, in this context, is the media industry. The last conference I went to, I've been to Jeff's conference once before, and I spoke for 10 minutes.
Right, in Los Angeles,
In Los Angeles, right, which was, hello, entertainment industry. And now here we are, the media industry, and I think the timing couldn't be better. I mean, because what we're witnessing now is sort of a minor earthquake in the technology industry with the shipment of the iPad and all this upheaval in Twitter land. The media people should be thinking now in terms of these kinds of upheavals in their world, because this is what we're now post-convergence.
Well, this was this was definitely a week where the two came together in a big way. That's for sure.
You think so? So go ahead, explain that.
I think that the iPad's release, which is a major event in the tech industry, is also seen as a major event in the news industry. And that's what I mean.
Have you had a chance to try an iPad out yet?
I haven't, because I'm not sure what I would use it for.
I should try it anyway.
I've been reading a lot about it, and I've been following the debates as best I can, but not yet as a user. I tend not to adopt things right away. I tend to wait a little while.
I didn't say adopt. I said try.
I
bought one, of course, and I have it with me, and I've tried it in a lot of different contexts. Used it flying on an airplane, flew across country. I've done a lot of demos for people. Basically, the way you demo it is just hand it to them and say, here, go for it. It's a relatively safe thing to do. And you get all kinds of insights doing that. And almost everybody loves it. I mean, it's a visceral sort of, it hits you somewhere personal.
Why is that?
Nice. Because they really grok design at Apple.
I
handed it to a friend, and she said, man, this thing doesn't feel plastic. And I said, yeah, this is the opposite of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's everything about it is like first class. It's the Mercedes of a category that didn't even exist. You know what I mean? It's like they start out, you know, not only do they give you the product, but, you know, invent a new category, but they also sort of define forever what quality is going to mean in that category. I mean, they're, you know, at the top of their game at Apple. And you know, all this stuff going on with Adobe finally makes sense. I don't know if you've been hearing about that. I think we've even talked about it. You know, no Flash
right.
on the iPad and the iPhone. And I read a column, and then Steve Jobs got involved in the discussion. I actually sent an email to somebody and then pointed to an article by Gruber.
I read it, yeah. Fireball. John Gruber, yeah.
Yeah. And and then there was an article that came out last night by Jean-Louis Gasset, who will understand this as well as anybody because he sat in Jobs' seat for a number of years and can explain the problem, you know, in very clear terms. And then Doc Searles read his wonderful piece in 1997 about, what to expect from Apple products. And, you know, they're ruthless about the quality of the product. It's not as insidious as I thought it was. You know, my interpretation of all this was, well, they're just trying to shut off every possible avenue of free content, but I don't think that's actually what they're doing. What they're doing is they're trying to avoid the mistakes of the least common denominator platform. They don't like cross-platform at Apple. What they like is you make products for our platform where you don't make them at all. It's as if they were trying to define quality in gasoline. You know, they're making a Mercedes, and they're saying, look, if you want to put gas into a Mercedes, it's really got to be very good gas. It can't be the kind of gas you put into every car.
Right. Did you read...
some argument to say that that's actually a good idea.
Did you read Stephen Johnson's argument to that effect?
Whose argument?
Stephen Johnson.
No.
In the New York Times. He said that he believes in open platforms and the generativity of them too, but you have to admit, he says, that Apple has succeeded to some degree with a closed platform because the explosion of creativity around the iPhone and now what's coming around the iPad kind of shows that there are advantages to it. So anyway, he made that argument.
Impossible to argue with it. It's obviously true.
Yeah.
Yet, however, being who I am, I love process of finding the reasons why I can't use this product. You see how twisted that is? The process of discovering why the product is useless to me is fun.
So tell me, what's that been like?
Well, because it's crafted. It's beautifully... I said in one of my pieces, I've written a lot of pieces about it over the last week. In one of my pieces, it feels like you're using a movie. That was crowd, you know, it's like there's a lot of theatrics to it. There's a lot of real, real small touches attention to detail that you just, you know, I've never seen it in software. It's never been tried. You know, I like to think that in the past I've, you know, been pretty good at that myself, but, you know, this is like a whole other level.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, it's so, you know, the thing that I hope from this is that we get the best of both worlds, that I don't think that the open version of the tablet computer is going to be as wonderful as this is from the aesthetic standpoint. It's mm-hmm. impossible. Maybe it will be, you know, it's possible, but I don't think it will be. But it will be a lot better than it would have been otherwise.
Right.
Because it will have this bar to try to get over, you know. And, you know, just like graphic operating systems, like the Macintosh made Windows possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it made, you know, the various graphic desktops that go on top of Linux possible. Let's hope that they're not too militant, you know. Let's hope that not everybody has to go to court to try to borrow from these ideas, you know. I don't know. That sounds pretty desperate, you know, when I hear myself say that.
Well, we have
because
to address...
I don't really believe we're going to get away with that, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm sure they're going to take people to court all over the place, you know.
Who is? Apple?
Apple, yeah, of course.
When people try to create the more open version of the iPad, you mean?
Yeah. Well, they borrow, well, they'll look at it differently. They'll say, well, you know, glad you like our product. Now, come up with your own ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. let's discuss whether the iPad, with its glories and amazing design, is going to change the rebooting the news equation. I mean, we have to bring it back to the content of the show.
Yeah, of course. And the answer is, and I reserve the right to change my mind, but the answer is no, it won't.
Because
it's deliberately not trying to do that. I mean, very deliberately not trying to do that. It's not a tool that somebody, that a source can use to go direct. It doesn't have a camera. It's terrible for writing. You wouldn't want to write with this thing. I mean, I wouldn't want to write with it. I can't imagine anybody would. I found that I had an insight into the iPad when I was sitting on the train from New York to JFK, and I had to wait till I could boot up my netbook to write the idea off. I mean, it's just ridiculous to even think about trying to express any kind of subtle idea that might require a little bit of editing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a few hundred words is unthinkable on this device.
Mm-hmm. Because
so
why?
Somebody said, what, pardon me?
Because why? Why is it so hard to write a thoughtful 300-word?
It doesn't have a keyboard. The keyboard isn't really designed for writing. It's maybe designed for quick emails or text messages or typing into a search box, you know, that kind of text. Not, you know, the kind of text that goes into writing a, you know, long an article on Scripting News or an article on PressThink or, you know,
right.
It's fine for Twitter. You know, I don't mind at all using it for Twitter. It's very good for Twitter. But it's not good for writing a blog post. Yeah.
Okay, so
that's what my mother said. When I showed my mother, you showed it to my mother, that's immediately, she said, she asked, well, does it have a camera? Because she loves taking pictures and uploading them to her blog. And she loves writing for her blog. And she said, well, show me how to write a blog post. So I did. She said, she pushed it away. She said, this isn't for me.
So there is something to the idea that it's backwards to the read-only web.
Right. Yeah, it's scary. It might even be a negative for rebooting the news.
Hmm.
Yeah, because, but on the other hand, reading the newspapers, you know, Scoble wrote a piece about this last night. Scoble at first was being Scoble in the first week and just said, oh, this is a game changer. This changes everything. I'll never use a computer again, blah, 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 you know. And I'm going, Scoble, it's no way, right? But, you know, he's doing his thing. Now he's settled, come back to Earth. And he says, it's not even good for curating the news. I can't even pass a link on to somebody. Now, I haven't given up on that yet, but I got to say, you're going to have to jump through a lot of really bizarre hoops to even just be able to shoot a link over to your friends on Twitter from the web browser. That's not going to be easy.
Did you see that for the iPad app that the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times have out, there are no comments, no links, and no ability to cut and paste.
Yeah, I did notice that. In other words, it's like, this reminds me, I made a trip to Jamaica, first time in 1980, and we were taking the bus from Montego Bay to the resort I was staying at. The driver pointed out the shacks the Cubans had built for the Jamaicans. He says, they're very nice, except there's no back door. Because when they so like when the police come to get you, you can't get out.
There's only one way.
Exactly.
I sent that... Immediately, I sent that note about the no links, no cut and paste, and no comments to Jennifer Preston, the social media editor of the New York Times. I said, Jennifer, what's going on here? But maybe it's just a first-generation product, and it'll evolve. And maybe the applications on the iPad will evolve. And there are people who say with a Bluetooth, people who say with a Bluetooth and you can plug in a keyboard and it's no problem.
Yeah.
And a super fast computer and a super fast browser, and you know, there's a counter argument there.
It's not only a super fast computer, and it is. I mean, it's really truly impressive how fast it does things. You know, the battery life on it is chin dropping.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's unbelievable. Apple always used to really not seem to not understand how important it is that you not have to plug the damn thing in, you know, all the time. This one, it leapfrogs. It's better than the netbook now. I mean, the netbook's fine. I don't have any problems. I have my netbook sitting next to me in the car right now. It's turned on. I'm not even thinking about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so they both reach that level of that's where you want your computing to be.
Right.
So I don't think that the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, and those are the two that I've looked at, and I've heard about others, I don't think they even reach the level of usefulness that anybody is actually going to use them on this device. They need to do a complete rethink of this thing. I mean, there are, you know, when you pick up one of these things, you want the news, we've been trained to believe that we ought to get news every time we look at the damn thing, right? You know, if you pick it up 15 minutes later, it shouldn't be the same as it was 15 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. And it is. And so that's not going to cut it. I've already got much better flow of news in several different places.
Well, I'm having dinner tonight with a bunch of other people and the editor of The Guardian. And he wrote something very enthusiastic about the iPad as the fulfillment of a vision he first saw 16 years ago when Knight Ridder was experimenting with a tablet computer. So I'll be interested to see what he thinks is transformative about it, but I haven't seen it yet. However, two things in the commentary about the iPad really stuck out for me, Dave. One was, and I think you linked to Cory Doctorow's piece, which was very, very skeptical and critical of the iPad. I saw a huge counter reaction to Doctorow from lots of people who just really didn't want to hear this at all, and actually described him as the old guard in computing, which I thought was
so
interesting.
It's totally not. It's like saying Thomas Jefferson's the old guard. I mean, I don't want to say Cory Doctorow and Thomas Jefferson in the same breath, really. But you know, his arguments are sound, and that's a
It is.
Somebody's the old guard.
The
you
old
haven't
guard.
Argued with him. You haven't rebutted him. You've just asked thrown an ad hominem at him. You said the guy's too old, you know? Well, screw you. Talk about his ideas if you want.
The other thing that really stuck out for me was that in those who feel the iPad is an advance and were kind of defended it against criticism that you might hear from Dr. or sometimes from you and others. When they heard this point that it really wasn't very good for making stuff and really was more a consumer device, would say, well, you know what? Most people don't want to make anything. Most people...
That was Howard Weaver.
Just Howard Weaver. I saw others say it too. Howard Weaver definitely said that. I saw it many, many times. You know what? You know, that's what you web intellectuals say and you bloggers say and some of the digerati, you know. But most people don't write. And I really object to that.
Most people don't vote either, Jay. day, but we want to make it possible for everybody to vote.
Exactly. You know? It's the same thing
we
with writing.
We want to make it really, really, really easy for people to do that when they finally have the idea that they can't get rid of, that they need to express to everybody. You want to make that really easy. It's like having a fire extinguisher. Most people don't need a fire extinguisher or a smoke alarm. You know, we put smoke alarms. Well, what do we need those? Most people don't use them, right? You put them there because you might need them someday.
Yes.
Might have a totalitarian government, and you might need the tools to talk about them. You know?
I would put it even stronger, Dave. I would put it in even stronger. I would say it's just like what Douglas Rushkoff said a few weeks ago, program or be programmed. I would say it's write,
I agree.
Write or be written. And the notion that we should reserve writing to an elite, or that's only this literate, you know, tiny cloister digerati that cares about everyone's ability to write, I just reject that completely. I think that is totally wrong. And everyone should learn how to edit. Everyone should learn how to write. Everyone should learn how to broadcast. And it's very similar to everyone should know how to vote and should have the right to vote.
Abbott, maybe everybody doesn't need to know how to read. I'd love to say that to Howard Weaver. Howard, maybe everybody doesn't need to know how to read. How do you feel about that?
Maybe everyone doesn't need to know how to consume your advertising. Maybe everyone doesn't need to know how to do that.
How about breathing? What do you think about that?
Yeah,
breathing okay? Can we do that?
But, you know, what really bothers me the most about this attitude is you have highly literate people themselves who are writers, who have blogs, looking at these other people out there as if they're kind of their defenders, or, you know, the people, and saying, well, they don't really want to write, you know? It's like, is that what you want for your children? Is that what you want for your daughter? You know, that she just be a reader, a consumer?
Why is it that we never hurl the ad hominems back? I mean, you know, to me, I'll tell you how this feels. It feels like hardening the arteries of the spirit. You know, you can't deal with having random people doing what you do because, obviously, you're not very confident in your ability to be one of the best. I mean, you're scared of something. I mean, that's not you, Jay. I'm talking about... Never mind, forget it. I don't need to go there. I am in that school, and I'm never going to leave it. And if you think that makes me a Luddite, you're an idiot. Okay, I don't need to argue with this. This isn't going to go anywhere. You've got a security blanket there, and another nice thing is going to make you want to give that thing up.
All right, let's move on. Before we get to the conflicts between Twitter and its developers, which is a very interesting story, I wanted to tell you about something else that you may not have noticed when you were packing up your life out there in California. But last week, Columbia School of Journalism announced that it has a new joint degree with the engineering school in computer science and journalism.
Mm-hmm. I did hear about that, actually.
Yes, and it'll be starting in the fall of 2010. It'll aim to accept about 15 students, about the same number that Studio 20 aspires to. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a 5-semester program with 3 terms in the engineering school and 2 in journalism. And they're looking to create, media hackers, news geeks, people who have programming skills and who know something about where journalism is going. So I think that's a positive development, is an interesting development. I just wanted to get your take on it.
I think we should be doing it at NYU. I think we should take this as an opportunity to, I'm a newbie, I'm an NYU newbie, okay? So this may not make a whole lot of sense, so you set me straight, but, you know, I see Columbia's competition, NYU, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair? Yeah. Well, when your competition does something innovative, that gives you internal support now, or a way to get internal support for being innovative, too. In other words, if somebody inside NYU had said, well, you know, we don't really see the benefit in doing this, you know, immediately, when I heard about this, I heard about it from Chris Wiggins, because I participated in the hackathon, which was a joint NYU-Columbia project.
Yes.
And it was quite interesting, but very nascent, very early. But I think had a lot of advantages over the way I've seen these things done on the West Coast. And he told me about it and immediately started, you know, I started getting ideas. And, you know, I would think the very first thing to try would be to have at least a seminar or a series of seminars on how to cover technology news.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah. And then you sort of get, that gives you the interdisciplinary, you know, of course it's a good idea, right? I mean, because, you know, it's an instance of what we, you and I, believe in on a more broad basis, which is that everybody ought to be covering what they do. Everybody ought to have the ability to write a news story about what it is that they care about, right? So that applies to technology as well. That's the one direction of this.
Yeah, that's a good way of starting, yeah. Well, I'll tell you.
Yeah. That's the pragmatic way of starting, Jay. I mean, you know, the other way says basically now we have to teach people how to create technology for news. And, you know, of course, that's something really close, near and dear to my heart. I'm absolutely all over that. I love it. That's what I do, you know?
Right.
And so, sure, I would love to be involved in that in any way possible. And I think some great things can be done there.
One thing we could do is we could try to figure out how to maybe do something similar at the undergraduate level. Because we already have a double major requirement at NYU. And computer science and journalism are both departments within the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. So in effect, we already have a joint program. We just have to kind of push it and shape it a little bit. The other thing to keep in mind, Dave, and that you wouldn't know this as an outsider to the university, is whenever you see joint degree programs, there's a way to tell how serious they are. The unserious version of a joint degree program is very easy to detect. It's, okay, students, you take a bunch of courses over here in Middle Eastern studies, and then you take a bunch of courses over here in economics, and that's the joint program in economics in the Middle East. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And you actually haven't created anything
whatsoever.
Yeah, you haven't actually created anything. You've just said we'll give you this degree,
delegates it to the students to figure out what the connection is. Right?
Exactly. So what you look
That's good. The students should be involved in figuring it out.
Well,
but
yes.
What you'd like to have is adults also.
Right. And so
very actively involved in it.
What you look for is where are the new courses and new experiences that, in a practical sense, bring these two things together? And how good are they? And how thoughtful are they? That's ultimately the place to look for how serious an effort this is.
Well, I think that's what you were thinking when you asked me to be part of this program. I mean,
let's
draw in technical talent into our journalism school so that now we can learn about what is at the intersection here, rather than just do the easy way of saying, you know, you put this thing together and we're not really going to worry about what the significance is.
Exactly.
That's where the value is in what the product is.
Exactly.
There are many of them, of course. Yeah.
We got to get two more things here: Twitter and the developers, and Jake Tapper and the fact checkers. So
why don't we go to Jake Tapper and the fact checkers first?
Okay.
Unless you want to go the other way first.
No, it's okay. Let me give the quick overview of this, the history here. In December, I wrote a post at my Postress called "My Simple Fix for the Messed Up Sunday Shows," and it made two points. The first was a big point, which is that if it's true, as journalists tell us, that the partisan divide in politics is worse than ever, then these political talk shows where you simply bring people from both sides of that widening divide together are doomed to failure because there's no common world of fact for them to occupy. And the smaller point was, if they wanted to do something about this, a simple way of starting to fix the situation would be simply to fact check their own guests and publish a check on them after the show. So the post got a lot of traction, and a lot of people said, you know, that's a really simple but effective idea. And one of the people who actually registered his interest in it was somebody I had mentioned in the post, Jake Tapper, who I knew was in line to possibly become the host of This Week, which is ABC's Sunday morning political talk show. So turns out that Tapper was listening. He's the temporary host of This Week from now until August, when Christian Amanpour of CNN takes over. And he decided to hook up with PolitiFact.com, which is a site from the St. Petersburg Times, which has really perfected the art of fact-checking statements from politicians by basically using data in really effective ways. And so he announced this last week that they were going to, in fact, do pretty much exactly what I said and fact-check the guests on This Week using PolitiFact.com to kind of outsource it to experts at it. And they started up this week for the first time. And the first few fact checks by PolitiFact.com are online today. And they actually did rate something that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said as half true. And it's working. So this is rare that something that I suggest actually gets implemented by the media.
Yeah, not kidding.
But it was kind of cool.
Well, who were the other guests? So we know Robert Gates was one of them. Who were the other
Hillary Clinton? Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates were together in one segment. And then there was Senator John Kyle of Arizona and the Republicans, and Senator Chuck Schumer of the Democrats on the Supreme Court vacancy and what's likely to happen there.
Right. I heard about that, yeah. And those are two guys, of course, that probably really could use some fact-checking, right?
Yes.
Highly partisan. Now, did you watch the show yourself?
I did.
You actually see?
I did.
Let me ask you, do you think that the guests were aware that they were going to be fact-checked?
Well, something interesting happened, and we don't know exactly what, but originally Rudy Giuliani was scheduled to be on.
And I see where you're going.
I described Rudy Giuliani as a target-rich environment for fact-checking. Which is actually a military term.
I know.
And after he was announced, they replaced him because suddenly they had this Supreme Court vacancy, so they wanted to do something about that. And they said, well, he'll be on later. So we don't know exactly what happened there. Maybe he expressed some reservations. Maybe it was a completely innocent thing and they just wanted to go with the Supreme Court segment. I'm not sure.
Well, but the dream, of course, is that these guys are on the show and they're aware of it.
Yeah.
And you actually hear them start mentioning it on the show. I'm not going to go there.
Well,
it would be really something. Of course, this is the way it should be. Right?
Yeah.
There should be the feedback loop. And the fact that it's after the fact, actually, I think is much better than if it were real time.
I think after the fact is better, yeah.
Yeah.
But something else happened, David. Something else happened today, which is really cool. Howard Kurtz was interviewing David Gregory, the host of Meet the Press, over the weekend, and he asked him about what ABC is doing, right? That's his competition across the street. And David Gregory says, it's an interesting idea, but we're not going to do it on Meet the Press. And then he says that viewers can fact check our show themselves if they want. And that's his like ta-ta to the idea. And I just think this is hilarious. I just think it's totally hilarious. Because what
Profiles in Mediocrity by David Gregory. He will always find the medium, which is, he would say that's a virtue, right? Because we're a centrist. We're going right down the middle. We're balanced. That points right to mediocre. And mediocre, if you just say medium and add the ochre at the end, you're there, right?
David Gregory is a comedy show. He is
so
hilarious.
Well, of course, Howard Kurtz and David Gregory kind of deserve each other. I don't know. Well, I mean, that's sort of like watching the Pope interview the Ayatollah.
Well, okay, I think Kurtz is a little stronger than a Gregory, in my opinion. But
I just heard a lot about the Pope this morning because I listened to All Things Considered re-roll about five times when they talked about the Pope today.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, speaking of the Pope, how about Twitter?
Yeah.
Twitter is like a really interesting case study in platform management. I mean, it's a textbook example, and it's being highly watched, and that's what's great about it. For the first time, you've almost got mainstream media, you do have mainstream media, watching the evolution of a platform, and it's all out there, laid bare for everybody to see. In the past, these things have happened, but they've always been simply tech industry insiders viewing them and learning the lessons from them. And, you know, as a result, for the first time that I remember seeing, the New York Times ran a piece about Twitter that wasn't all gee whiz. You know, it wasn't, you know.
It was about the tensions between developers and Twitter, the platform, yeah.
Yeah, so a little bit of reality is starting to seep in there. And there, of course, has been this great divorce between reality and the coverage Twitter has gotten. The fact is, the developers have been competing with Twitter from the beginning. There's never been a moment they weren't competing with Twitter. It's just that it's now completely out in the open. And that's what happens when you are doing work with a corporate platform. That's why there are almost contradictions in terms. You can't really have a platform that is owned by a corporation. It's not a platform. It doesn't behave like a platform.
Mm-hmm.
It goes through these gyrations. There's one element to that platform that has so much more power than everybody else that it's, you know, the idea of a platform has implied in it, there's implication that there's a level to it, right? That it's, you know, platforms don't have peaks and valleys to them, right?
Right.
It's basically just very flat, almost level flat. And, well, this one clearly knows, you know, corporate platforms are not platforms. Doesn't work. So they decided to that they needed to have a client, and so they purchased Tweety, which was in some ways the leading client on the iPhone, and they created a BlackBerry client as well. And in doing so, put a lot of pressure on all the other client developers, probably so much pressure that it's going to force many of them to stop developing. Because their hope for liquidity is just sort of dashed.
Mm-hmm.
Not much hope for it. So.
But aren't they also having
not a bad thing.
Aren't they also having a conference with developers?
Yeah. It's a developer conference this week, right?
So that must be kind of a dramatic event, don't you think?
Their first one. I don't know how dramatic. I'm not there, as you can see.
Right.
I used to go to Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference. That was the corporate platform conference that I used to go to. And they were very, very frustrating affairs for developers. I remember once they were in forever. The time between their System 6 and System 7 was years. I mean, there was like 3 years. They had announced System 7. You know, there's always this mode where you've announced the next one, but you're still selling the old one. And the developers, of course, don't have any choice. They have to ship for the old one because they don't have to ship for. And so I actually heard an Apple guy up there on stage saying, well, we understand if you feel you have to ship a new product for System 6, but we would prefer if you didn't. This was after there had already been a year and a half, 2 years wait for the new operating system. And the place just erupted in angry yelling and screaming. I mean, the guy meant it had the best of intentions in saying it. But, you know, there's this lack of empathy that goes across this boundary. The platform, people who work at the platform vendor feel it. They work really hard. Nobody listens to them. You know, nobody in management cares. Management doesn't understand the issues, and they come in and make these capricious decisions, and they have to live with them and implement them. Meanwhile, the developers get rich and harvest all the benefits, and they get all the credit. They're the ones that get interviewed. They get famous and whatever, and, you know, and meanwhile, I'm doing all the work.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they feel about it. Now, I flip it over to the developer. What the platform vendor guy doesn't understand is that he's only looking at the 0.1% of the developers who get rich.
Right.
Almost all of them are broke and have no hope of ever getting rich. And so they toil endlessly, and the platform vendor is always breaking them. So you're constantly trying to keep up with the changes that they make.
Right.
Then Fred Wilson wrote a piece, which...
I read it.
The politics were breathtaking. Fred, they're all just getting... The problem is that these guys are all new at platform management. They've never done it before. Whereas you contrast that with Steve Jobs, who's now, and not just Steve, but everybody else at Apple, this is their fifth punt around the loop.
Right.
So they know when they see Adobe coming in doing what Adobe does, they know what's going to happen next. You know? So they know, let's cut it off right now so that we don't have to deal with this later, right? Whereas Twitter is like, they're surprised at every turn that, what, you mean you don't like when we kill your business? Wait a minute, we're doing it for good reasons. They are doing it for good reasons, but their bedside manner is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally awful. I mean, Fred Wilson wrote a piece where he scolded the developers for not covering any interesting territory. Well, the reason the developers aren't doing that is that they don't open the API up enough to do anything interesting with it. There you go. If they were willing to be more courageous, if Twitter were willing to take some more chances with their API, then you'd get better apps.
And it's a highly political situation.
100%.
Yeah.
Politics. Absolutely. It's all there really is to it, is politics. Yep. Yeah.
But and politics is an inescapable part of life.
Absolutely. And it goes back to the Cory Doctorow story. I mean, it's exactly the same issue, and the arguments are almost eerily the same. You know, the people who back the platform vendor without considering the developer's point of view are typically used the "you're a Luddite, you're old school,
mm-hmm.
you need to move on." You know? And the developer is stuck there. Marco Arment from, I've mentioned him before.
Yes.
In the show is an incredible canary in the coal mine. And if you read his piece and you don't feel sympathetic, then you don't have a heart. I mean, because here's a guy who believed, this was a case of Apple, but it could have just as easily been Twitter, who just simply believed in the platform. He argued on their behalf. I thought irrationally. This is a really smart guy, but he just believed. And they pulled the rug out from under him, and there it is in black and white. And yet, almost all the comments were, why don't you get over it? We need to move forward. You're a crybaby. Quit crying, blah, blah, blah. And, the fact is, in these situations, there's two sides to it. And the inescapable answer is, you need to have a platform with no platform vendor to get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get there any other way.
And you were quoted more or less to that effect in the New York Times story.
I was.
Yeah.
Finally, an accurate quote.
Well, they took it from your blog, right?
Yeah, well, actually, to be truthful, I did talk with her background. And, not for attribution.
90 seconds.
What I asked her to do, which is, if she wanted to quote me, take it off the blog.
Yeah, I was going to say, it actually worked the way you wanted.
Yeah.
It rarely works that
way. She was smart. That woman, she did a very good job with the piece. She did something very interesting in the context of rebooting the news. I asked her at the end of the conversation, when is your piece running? And she said it's running Monday's paper. And so I always like to watch the process.
60 seconds.
I also like to time my own writing so that it comes out, roughly coincident with that. And I also know that while she's doing the piece, if I write a blog post, she might read it and it might end up influencing her article. Well, the day after I talked with her, she wrote a thing on the Bits blog. And I thought, okay, that's all that this was. This is a blog post, and she accelerated it. And then she wrote another and another. Right? And I thought, well, okay, I don't get what's going on here. And then Monday, her big piece wrote.
Yep, that's how they do it now.
This is what we've been asking.
Yeah.
Right?
That's how Mayans Delta does it, too.
Process.
Yeah. They've definitely learned how to do that, no question about it.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yet, however, I'll tell you something. I did also get a pointer from them in that piece. They pointed to my blog post. And they're not getting
10
a lot of flood.
Seconds.
Scoble also pointed to one of my pieces. And that got me maybe 3-4 times as many hits as the New York Times.
And
so they're just beginning, I think.
And that's all the time we have today, Dave. Great show.
Oh, is that it? We're done?
Yep. Can't wait to see you back in New York.
Thank you, Jay. Talk to you soon.
Bye.